Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A day after former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi appeared at the opening session of his court trial, many local newspapers described him as behaving, quote, hysterically, after he told the judges, quote, I am Dr. Mohamed Morsi, and I am the President of the Republic, end quote. Morsi and 14 members of the Muslim Brotherhood have been charged with inciting violence during clashes late last year outside of the presidential palace, during which 10 people died. After two disruptions in the courtroom, the presiding judge postponed the trial for 2 months. It's scheduled to resume on January 8th. Joining us to talk about coverage of the trial and the current situation on the ground in Egypt is Nancy Youssef, McClatchy's Middle East Bureau Chief based in Egypt. Hi, Nancy. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And here in the U.S., last Friday, the food stamp program got hit with a massive $5 billion cut. The cut will affect all 47 million Americans enrolled in the program. Individuals will lose $11 a month. A family of four receiving the maximum benefit will get $36 less per month. The average allotment is about $4 per day. According to Media Matters, the nightly news programs failed to mention the cuts. From October 29th to November 1st, the day the cuts went into effect, MSNBC devoted 9 segments during the 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. window. NBC and CBS each provided 1 segment, while CNN, Fox, and ABC failed to provide any segments. Arthur Delaney has been covering the cuts for the Huffington Post, where he is a staff reporter. Hi, Arthur. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Great to have you. And Michael Hiltzik has also been writing about these cuts. Michael is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Arthur, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I love a story that ran in the Wall Street Journal yesterday by Sarah Tilton. It is about the rise in demand for housekeepers and butlers. And it says, in San Francisco, Town and Country Resources, a staffing agency for domestic help, has seen demand for estate managers and trained housekeepers grow so fast, the agency is going to offer its own training programs in subjects like laundry, ironing, and spring cleaning starting in 2014. So the super rich are doing super great. That is
wow.
The moral of the story.
Yeah, and in San Francisco, we got new multi-gazillionaires because Twitter went public yesterday. And it's unbelievable, but the market cap is about $18 billion, maybe even more, because the stock went up. And the Chronicle had an article about the men, they're all men, who are now multimillionaires because of that.
And everyone in the news was just cheerleading that IPO as if it were not about enriching rich people and shareholders and not the, totally separate from the broader economy and the fortunes of the rest of America. So a weird emphasis on shareholders,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, we need to really talk about this, I think, in the coming weeks, because Twitter also got a payroll tax cut for coming to San Francisco. So here's a company valued at $18 billion, and they're not paying payroll taxes.
Wow, I hadn't heard of that. That's really something.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, Arthur. So Wall Street Journal, housekeeping and butlers, there's big demand in San Francisco. Michael, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd like to shout out to all of the journalists who've been busy as I've been debunking some of these Obama horror stories that we see on CBS and NBC and in the Wall Street Journal and on Fox News. Eric Stern, Epsilon, did a great job, not this past week, but a couple of weeks ago, in doing some truth squatting on three couples who had appeared on Sean Hannity's show. Igor Volsky, just this past week on the Think Progress website, did a great debunking of a woman who had appeared, who had told her story to the Wall Street Journal in an op-ed, San Diego cancer patient, who was complaining that she was losing her insurance. And as Igor and I both pointed out, the fact is that she was losing her insurance because her insurance company, who she characterized as compassionate and fair, was withdrawing from the California market for business reasons of its own. So, and there have been many others who've been doing this, and I think They all need recognition.
Huh. Yeah, so this piece is inside the Fox News lie machine. I fact-checked Sean Hannity on Obamacare. So he basically had people on who talked about how they were losing their insurance, but then he found that there was a lot of misinformation behind their stories.
Right, and I think we found that in a lot of these stories. I mean, there are people who are not losing their insurance, but who are discovering that they're going to have to pay more, sometimes for better insurance, sometimes for equivalent insurance, or even maybe with higher deductibles and higher out-of-pocket expenses. But the entire individual health insurance market is transitioning right now, and that's going to happen. And one thing that's almost never said when TV networks or indeed newspapers write about people experiencing, quote, sticker shock, is that the transition is going to bring access to health insurance to millions upon millions of people. That's the other side of it, and it really all needs to be balanced.
Well, what does balance mean in this case? Because obviously, if these people lied, they should be called out, and so should Sean Hannity. But we did a show about healthcare yesterday, and the fact is 3.5 million people have received cancellation letters. We're going to see a lot more in California from Blue Shield subscribers, about 80,000. And, I mean, everybody has a different story, but there's a lot of outrage out there because the premiums are going to go up sometimes by 50%.
Well,
so how should the media deal with this?
This needs to be put in real perspective, and that's something that I think our colleagues in the press have not been doing a good job about. First of all, people are receiving cancellation notices. That's not at all the same as people losing their insurance, because the idea is that they can go on the exchanges, they don't have to go on the exchanges, but they can, and they can replace that insurance, not by any means always at a higher price, not by any means always are they going to get inferior or more costly insurance than they have now. Time and time again, we hear these stories, we read about them, we are not told what are they paying now, what are the terms of their current insurance, and how does that compare with what they're going to be able to get next time around. Now, sometimes it's true. Sometimes they're getting great prices and great insurance, but invariably that's because they have a record of good health. And the question always is, when you're talking about the individual insurance market, is what are they going to face if, in fact, they have a medical crisis or a medical condition? Let's talk about the woman, Edie Sunby, in the Wall Street Journal. What I pointed out when I wrote about her earlier this week is that although her insurance company, United Health, is withdrawing from the California market, she went on the exchange. She says she found insurance that's not going to have all of her cancer doctors in its network. She doesn't say whether it's going to be more expensive or less expensive. She doesn't say what she's going to face in terms of out-of-pocket expenses or what she faces today. But one thing she does not talk about that we know to be true is that before Obamacare, before the Affordable Care Act went into effect, if her insurance company withdrew, as United Health clearly wanted to do for years, it only has 8,000 customers in this particular market, if it withdrew and she had to find insurance as a stage 4 gallbladder cancer patient, she would be uninsurable before Obamacare. With Obamacare, she is going to be able to find insurance, and we know that to be true. We don't need her to say it or not, because that's the way the law works.
Well, again, we did a show about this yesterday, so you can find the show on the website, yourcallradio.org, along with the two stories that we just talked about. So thank you for that one, Michael, and kudos again to Eric Stern at Salon. And Nancy Youssef, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, a story I enjoyed reading very much from here was by Egypt Independent about women in riding their bikes and trying to get the right to ride a bike. It's something that perhaps we take for granted in the United States, but in Egypt it's hard for a woman to ride a bike. It's considered dishonorable and it hurts their ability to have children. And to see these veiled women trying to start a movement so that they can ride their bike, riding along the streets, I just found really inspiring, and I just enjoyed it. I'm a bike rider myself and haven't been able to ride a bike since I've lived here, so I guess I have a bit of a bias, but I just love their enthusiasm and their willingness to sort of keep up the revolutionary spirit. You know, we talk so often about mass protests and the presidency and elections and stuff, but that revolutionary spirit, to me, was evident in seeing photos of these women riding through the streets of Cairo.
Huh. What is the state of the revolution and the revolutionary spirit?
In a lot of ways, it's been hurt in the sense that people feel like the expectations of 2011 weren't met, that this hope of a better, stronger, more prosperous Egypt hasn't panned out. Most Egyptians are living worse than they were in 2011, and that was just something that was unimaginable in 2011. And there's a real question here about the value of these sort of uprisings. On top of that, a lot of the people who spurred the 2011 uprising, a lot of people who called for revolutionary change, have either fled the country or are in hiding because there are fears that they will be arrested and prosecuted under this new civilian government, the one that was named by the military after Morsi's ousting. And so I would say it's not very optimistic right now. So for me, that story was just particularly positive in light of that.
Hmm. How long have you been there, Nancy?
I've been here since April 2012.
That is Nancy Youssef. She's McClatchy's Middle East Bureau Chief based in Egypt. And if you have any questions for her about media coverage of the trial and also the current situation in Egypt, it's almost fallen off the front pages here in the U.S. And as she said, a lot of people have been discouraged and disenchanted. A lot of people are in hiding because of just possible jail time or worse. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So before we talk about media coverage of the trial, Nancy, can you give us just a sense of what people are saying right now? What does it feel like on the streets in Cairo?
About the trial?
No, just in general, just the overall mood.
Well, I think the biggest change, and one that you mentioned in terms of the coverage, is up until this point, there's been a lot of dramatic change in Egypt. Every week there was some turn. There was an expectation that protests would lead to big changes. And I think Egypt right now is sort of setting in for not so much drama, really, but rather than seeing changes every week, that the kinds of changes that they were looking for might take months or years. And that new reality is just starting to set in. There's a lot of enthusiasm for the military, which is surprising in light of the fact that people are rising up against them just 2 years ago after former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak resigned. There's a lot of anticipation about the upcoming constitutional referendum and the parliamentary and presidential elections. So there's a feeling that Egypt's entering a new chapter, both in terms of process and also mentality and approach towards the call for change here.
What explains the support for the military at this point?
I think very simply that, you know, Egypt has always sort of battled between its sort of military-guided government and political Islam and an Islamic-led government. And there's such a wholesale rejection of Morsi and the Brotherhood by a big portion of the people, certainly not all, but a big portion of people, that there's a feeling that the military option's better, that even if they are suppressing people's rights, which appears to be happening, even if they're cracking down on certain Egyptians, which is also happening, that they are a better alternative. And I also think that there's a feeling that if the military goes too far, that in the back pocket is still the power of the street. So that there's a reassurance, I think, among some Egyptians that the military can only go so far because for however tumultuous and stressful and difficult the last 2 years have been, that Egyptians are empowered with the street and that hasn't been taken away from them. I think all those things come together to lead people to say, we're going to support the military. They're the only people who can lead us right now. They're the best alternative of the two options we have, and they're the only ones who can perhaps pull us out of this economic and political hole, if you will.
Even though more than 1,000 Morsi supporters were killed since he was ousted back in July. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, you bring that up to Egyptians, and they'll say, that was a necessary thing that had to happen. It's interesting the way democracy and things are being defined. Remember, it's a very new concept. These are people who haven't really experienced it. And we define democracy as protecting all. But in Egypt now, there's a real struggle with that the definition is protecting my interests.
Hmm.
And so from their perspective, those deaths were a necessary evil to protect the interests of Egypt. And it's a justification that I have a hard time wrapping my mind around. But it's something that's quite prevalent amongst supporters of the military effort to quash the Brotherhood. And that in a sense that those were necessary casualties to rid the nation of the Muslim Brotherhood's grip, and from the perspective of those who defend the military, their destruction of the country.
And what is the status of rule right now as Mohamed Morsi and some members of the Brotherhood are facing charges and appeared in court this week? I mean, who's running the country at this point?
Well, the military, when they ousted Mohamed Morsi on July 3rd, they named Abdel Mansour, who is a judge, as the president. We don't see much of him, but there's an understanding that it's really being guided by the military and its defense minister and chief of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and he is really seen as a leader of the country. The graffiti on the walls are not about Abdel Mansour. They're either for or against Sisi, and so it's understood that while it's a civilian-led government, the strings are being pulled by the military.
That is Nancy Youssef, McClatchy's Middle East Bureau Chief based in Egypt. Arthur Delaney is a reporter with the Huffington Post, and Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Los Angeles Times. And before we let Nancy go, we're also going to ask her a question about Benghazi. But before we do that, Arthur or Michael, do you have any questions for Nancy?
No, I think she's basically laid it out as thoroughly as anybody I've heard.
What about you, Arthur?
I'm with Michael. I really appreciate the perspective on the ground there.
Okay. Well, yeah, and it's, like I said, it's almost missing from our front pages. And I just wanted to ask you quickly, Nancy, because you have reported from Benghazi. There's been a lot of coverage about this 60 Minutes report by Laura Logan, and she apologized, saying that the network was wrong for a report that raised questions about the Obama administration's response to the attack on the compound in Benghazi, which left four Americans dead, including the ambassador Christopher Stevens. She says, quote, "In this case, we were wrong. We made a mistake. That's disappointing for any journalist. It's disappointing for me." And it involves this source she relied on, a security contractor using the pseudonym Morgan Jones, later identified as Dylan Davies. He said he was able to reach the Benghazi compound, scale a wall, and even fight off a militant. In the piece, she did not say that he was a contractor. And when the story aired, it cast doubt on whether the Obama administration sent all the help that was possible to save the four Americans. What are your thoughts on this? And why is the story about Benghazi so just completely changing constantly, or it's different depending on where you go to read about it?
Well, those are all good questions. I think my sort of takeaway from it was the reason the story was so exclusive is that he was offering details that nobody else had, where everyone else said that they couldn't get anywhere near the compound. He had claimed that he had gotten through the attackers, had jumped scaled a 12-foot-high wall, got in, rifle-butted one of the attackers, and although it didn't explain what happened after that. So that was really new, because our understanding was nobody could get near it, and certainly the people that I talked to that night couldn't. And his other claim was that he was able to sneak into Benghazi Medical Center and see Chris. And I talked to the doctor who treated him, and they were astonished that Chris came in by himself. And so that was a new claim. My own takeaway from it is that the apology and the retraction certainly hurts 60 Minutes' credibility, which is upsetting, given what a wonderful reputation it has. But I think it also sort of gets at 14 months later after this attack, we still don't know basic facts about what happened that night. It was his claims that were making it so newsworthy because these questions are still lingering out there. Basic questions about why the attack happened, who was involved in the attack, if it was planned, how long before it was planned. And I know for those who knew and loved Chris, I've spoken to some of them. There's a real frustration at that those questions aren't being asked, and rather there appears to be this another sort of use of this case for other people's purposes. In this case, a contractor trying to sell a book.
How difficult is it to report from Benghazi right now?
It's quite difficult. I'm planning to go in soon, so I'll have a better sense in about a week or so. The challenge is it's not governed by the Libyan government that the United States supports. It's Eastern Libya. There's a faction of it that declared independence from the rest of the state. It's run by militias. It's run by insurgent groups, not by any sort of governing force. And there's been a call for assassinating Americans and kidnapping Americans there, and so it's very difficult to move. I can tell you that every time I've gone in, most recently in June, people know who I am within 2 days and are following me within 2 days. And so it's an ungoverned state, and if something happens to you, there is no sort of the normal channels don't work. You can't go to your embassy. You can't go to the Libyan government because they have no better sense or contact within this sort of ungoverned space than anybody else does. Mm.
Well, Nancy, we'd love to have you on maybe after your trip to find out how it went.
I would be delighted.
All right. Thank you so much for staying up late to join us.
My pleasure.
That is Nancy Youssef. She is McClatchy's Middle East Bureau Chief based in Egypt, and you can read her reporting about what's happening on the ground in Egypt at yourcallradio.org. Arthur Delaney is a staff reporter with the Huffington Post, and Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the LA Times, and they have both been reporting on the massive $5 billion food stamp cut that just went into effect last week. They've also been reporting on possible cuts to Social Security and misinformation around the CPI. So we'll talk about that after a break. But first off, I wanted just to ask you both about this Media Matters report, basically saying that the program, the food stamp cuts, failed to get really any attention on the networks and the cable shows. MSNBC did devote nine segments to it, whereas CNN, ABC, and Fox devoted nothing. Arthur, you report that this is massive. This is going to affect 47 million Americans.
That's right. And before the cut, as it was approaching, there was even less media attention. So the segments, I think, that Media Matters counted up came a little later. And after people had already, you know, all 50 million people on the program had received notice in the mail, but then didn't see that reflected in the national conversation. And the reason for that is that it was not through a political fight that this cut came about. It was not because Republicans were trying to cut food stamps through the farm bill, which is something that they are pursuing separately. It had a sort of obscure origin in these two Democratic bills from 3 years ago. So Democrats didn't want to talk about it. Republicans are shy about being associated with food stamp cuts. So the story lacked the kind of political conflict that gets journalists and assignment editors interested in it, and that's why it may have seemed to just come out of nowhere.
Mm. Well, we'll continue talking about this after the break, and we should say that these stories do get really good coverage at the local level, where you actually have quotes from people. The food banks say that there's no possible way they're going to be able to meet demand. So we'll continue talking about that after the break, along with the lack of coverage about possible cuts to Social Security. We'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted on the website, yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And don't forget that tomorrow, Rose Aguilar and Your Call producer Maliha Razazan will be broadcasting live from the Green Festival here in San Francisco for 2 hours, 12 to 2. More information at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about how global warming is affecting the oceans. We'll have a conversation about ocean acidification and how the oceans work. And then we're also putting shows together next week about transition towns, the global movement against fracking, and we'll also be joined by members of Greenpeace. They have brought their Rainbow Warrior ship to the West Coast. They're going to be giving free tours starting tomorrow. You can find more information at greenpeace.org. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable. We're talking about media coverage of the massive $5 billion cut that hit the food stamp program last week. This will affect all 47 million Americans enrolled in the program. We'll also be talking about possible cuts to Social Security and just some other social issues that aren't really getting much attention. Today, we're joined by Arthur Delaney. He is a staff reporter with the Huffington Post, and Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the LA Times. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you saw a story that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. And what are your thoughts on coverage of things like Social Security, food stamps? A new report just came out that student homelessness has hit a record high in the United States. There were 1.2 million homeless students during the 2011-2012 academic year. Healthcare is getting the majority of the coverage, but what about these other issues? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Michael, you've been writing about all of these issues. How do you explain this Media Matters report that the food stamp cut, which is huge, $5 billion, barely got notice on the networks and the cable shows?
Well, I think what Arthur said is quite true, and I would expand on that a little bit. When we're talking about the food stamp cut specifically, what's interesting to me about it is the subtlety that this is the result of inaction by Congress. For this cut to be averted, Congress had to take a vote. And I think everybody looks at Congress right now and says, you're simply not going to get a vote out of this Congress, particularly out of the House of Representatives, that involves more spending on social policy, more spending on social programs. So when I wrote about this coming food stamp cut, In the week before it actually happened, I talked to food stamp advocates, and I said, what are the chances that this can be averted? And they said, look, there's not even a bill in the House, there's not even a bill in the Senate to avert this, so the chances really are nil. And I think that's something that the news media has a lot of trouble with when you're talking about a policy that requires some sort of affirmative action by Congress. There's not a lot of interest because inaction really represents no conflict. There's nothing for the television news or indeed the newspapers to sink their teeth into. And I think that's what's happened here. And then when you combine that with the fact that social policy, social insurance programs, relief programs are by their nature complicated, the conversation that we seem to be having about them on the national level, this is a success, I think, of the conservative movement, is they're now portrayed as artifacts of fiscal policy. And I think that is a real error, and that's a real problem, because when you start putting Social Security, disability, food stamps, Medicare, in the context purely as a fiscal policy balancing act, then you've already lost the battle for the people who are beneficiaries of these programs. And I think that's a problem. And I think that's been a real failure of the press and the news media to make sure people understand what's at stake when you portray these as merely expense items on the federal ledger.
Well, so you used to be a reporter, and now you write a column for the LA Times. So you're
I'm a reporter, though.
Okay, well, right. I mean, you're definitely a reporter, but you throw in these zingers in your columns that you definitely probably couldn't put in your reports, right? You've got a very strong opinion in your column, and I'm wondering, well, you know, when you talk to your colleagues about these issues, what goes on behind the scenes at the LA Times? How do your editors decide how to cover issues like this at a time when, you know, you just type in the word poverty or homelessness, and it seems like new records are being broken on a regular basis?
Well, I don't think that our editors are averse to having these stories in the paper. I think it really represents what has to happen is that the reporters on the ground and the columnists on the ground have to do the work. It's always been my experience, and I've been at this for 30 years, actually, is that if you come to an editor and you have a story, the editor's inclination is to publish it. If you go to an editor and say, do you want a story on X, Y, or Z, essentially the editor understands that what you're asking for is a no. You're asking to be told, don't bother, go look at something else. So in my experience, what's always worked is to go do the work, present the story, and have something in hand that can be put in the paper. So I think you can't really blame. I've never seen an editor say, I don't want a story on poverty. I've never heard an editor say, I don't want you to do a story about how federal policy is hurting people. So it really is up to the reporters. And I think because these policies are made in Washington, as you observed, there's a lot of local coverage of the implications of all this. In Washington, I think the Washington Press Corps tends to be focused on process and not on policy and its implications. And I think that's something that really has to change for all of the coverage of these issues to be improved.
Arthur, what would you add to that, specifically on the question of how these stories actually get published?
Well, at the Huffington Post, a story about the federal government doing something that results in benefits being taken away from 50 million people, that, we love to put that on the front page, and we may have made a lot of big, we call it the splash, the big box at the top of the front page, and food stamps spend a lot of time there. But other than in the sort of more establishment media, with regard to food stamps, people just weren't aware of it. And it was an amazing contrast. I have a Google alert for the words food stamps, and it's usually pretty busy, but in the past few weeks, it's been going crazy. I'm getting emails every few minutes, and that's because local TV stations and newspapers all across the country were all over this story, and they tended to have food stamp recipients saying, well, I guess I'll be $20 hungrier next month. And they had a lot of food bank directors saying, how are we going to respond to the increased needs? So I think part of that was because, the local news was paying attention to something that was important to the community, and also partly food bank directors are very savvy about how to get attention and get donations. But it was an amazing dichotomy between the local and the coverage out across the country and the coverage from the Beltway. Totally different approaches.
And then we might see even more cuts when the new farm bill is passed, right?
Yeah, and on that score, the Beltway media will be on top of it, because those will come through a grinding policy debate that has been underway for 2 years and is coming to a head in the conference committee, which is the House and Senate meeting together to hash out a farm bill, and food stamps are part of the farm bill. And since that story has, winners and losers and political personalities, the D.C. Press Corps will definitely be letting the world know what will be the collateral damage for the people on food stamps as a result of that battle.
I agree with Arthur on that. When you're talking about the aspect of the food stamp program and juxtaposing it with the ag bill and farm subsidies, that's an easy story for Washington reporters to grasp. It's right in their wheelhouse. As Arthur said, there are winners and losers. There are good guys and bad guys. Yeah, that's going to be covered all over the place. But that's exactly why this cut, which is much greater than even the cut that the House of Representatives want on an annual basis, this is why this cut went under everybody's radar in Washington.
That is Michael Hiltzik. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's been a reporter for 30 years. Arthur Delaney has been covering these issues for the Huffington Post, where he is a staff reporter. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on coverage of these important issues? And if you saw a story this week that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear about it. 866-798-8255, 866 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. I just got an email from Daniel in San Francisco who says, sitting here listening to your show and reading the news online, I stumbled onto this story on the Al Jazeera website. 54 people arrested during a peaceful labor protest outside of Walmart in Los Angeles. He writes, while it might not be headline news, I am shocked and dismayed that none of the major American news outlets are even reporting this. I don't believe in conspiracies, but I also don't believe in coincidence. Denses. When no one is reporting on a story, there must be treachery afoot. Well, thank you for that. There's been a lot of action with Walmart. You've probably been following this. And Michael, you're in L.A. This was in front of the new Walmart in Los Angeles.
Well, that's right. And in fact, this story is on our front page, or at least at the moment it's on the front page of our website.
Yeah, the writer is mistaken about this being ignored.
I saw it on a lot of publications last night.
Yeah.
Because that's when it happened. So, Michael, this is on your front door.
Yeah, it is right now. Now, that's not to say that the story has necessarily gotten the attention that it deserves, but I think this does feed into a story that is getting a lot more attention, and that is action by organized labor against companies like Walmart who are systematically cheaping out on their workers, and I think it's going to be very important. I think labor sees this as a real opportunity, and rightly so, to bring the plight of minimum wage workers and minimum wage clerical workers and retail workers to the attention of the public. So I think this is good. This is working. This is exactly the sort of action that does get attention. And at least in Los Angeles, where we are, it is getting attention.
Yeah, and again, Walmart workers are planning a massive Black Friday protest the day after Thanksgiving, just like they did last year. And let's talk a little bit about what's happening with unemployment. And we got some new numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it showed that the labor market gained 204,000 jobs in October. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the unemployment rate was little changed in October, ticking up slightly to 7.3%. But if you count in the 6.1 million missing workers, these are the workers who have dropped out of the job force because they can't find a job, the unemployment rate would be 10.8%. And Arthur, you've got a piece about unemployment benefits expiring for about 1.3 million Americans at the end of the year.
That's right. And this is actually a deadline that has occurred every year during Barack Obama's presidency, the expiration of federal unemployment insurance for people who have exhausted the usual 6 months of benefits that states provide. But I think this year will be different in that we'll do this, the usual running up to the deadline and people pointing out that, you know, millions will be affected. But in previous years, Congress did something about it and kept the benefits going. But I think now that the unemployment rate is, approaching 7% going down, they might just let the benefits drop this time. And the other reason for that is that usually, you know, every Christmas there's a crisis of governing where they have the fiscal cliff, the payroll tax cut. This year there's nothing like that. There's government funding comes up in the middle of January, and that's the closest the unemployment insurance will get to having something to hitch itself to. So I think unemployment, it's also a symptom of the fact that that story is basically falling off the radar. Though the minimum wage stuff is getting lots of attention, like Michael said, and I think that's actually moving the pile, to use a football metaphor, because that I don't think President Obama would have come out yesterday in favor of a $10 minimum wage if it hadn't been for all this labor agitation the past year.
And then a few victories at the ballot box on Tuesday. There was a minimum wage increase by a dollar in New Jersey, even though the governor, Chris Christie, vetoed it. And then the highest minimum wage now is a town right outside of Seattle, Washington, $15 an hour. Mainly for airport workers. So we're seeing a lot of movement on minimum wage across the country at the ballot box.
Yeah, and this is how it used to be done in this country. There were, for hundreds of years even, protests, strikes, general strikes, mass arrests, actual unrest is how we got weekends, how we got minimum wages, how we got all the good things that workers, some people take for granted. And it seems to be working, again, on this small scale, getting policy attention and maybe creating reputational costs for the companies that don't pay you enough to really make a living without relying on food stamps.
Michael, how would you say reporters, or how do you connect the dots? Because you have a column, CEO to worker pay gap is obscene. Want to know how obscene? And you write that corporate America is fighting a proposed SEC rule requiring companies to calculate the ratio of their CEO's pay to the median pay of their employees. A graphic has been going around on Facebook, and it's really incredible to see. You point out in your piece that just one example, Ron Johnson's 2011 compensation at JCPenney was $53 million, more than 1,795 times the average Penny worker's pay, about 25, 30 grand a year. And then a new study came out that found for the very first time, the 10 highest CEOs in the U.S. all received more than $100 million in compensation. Two took home billion-dollar paychecks, including the CEO of Facebook. So how do you connect the dots? Because there are a lot of dots to be connected here between these reports we get about CEOs and then going down to food stamp cuts.
Well, this is a rich load of material that I think it's mined okay, but not nearly as much as it should be. I think what you do is you have to show that income inequality really is what accounts for a lot of the ways that Americans are dealing with issues like social insurance and unemployment and all these other things. Because when you have income inequality on this scale, essentially people who are at the lower end begin to think that they have to be in this for themselves, that they lose the idea that we're all in this together and that social policy and social insurance is something that benefits everybody. So the rise in income inequality that we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years really has been damaging to the social fabric. And I think that's something that we cannot stop pointing out. Now, when you talk about CEO pay and CPO pay as a ratio to the average worker in the companies, a couple of points that you have to make is that this is a very visible manifestation of income inequality. It's the upstreaming of the gains from worker productivity and of corporate profits to the very top, not just the top five corporate executives, but to shareholders, as opposed to returning these gains to labor that contributes so much to income inequality. This is very, very important to point out. And of course, corporations don't really want the sort of vivid graphic evidence coming out that the SEC rule would require, so they're fighting it tooth and nail. So these are very, very important things, and I think there's a fair amount of coverage of inequality, but I think the implications of it are not really analyzed with any great depth in the press.
And it seems like this is what the people want, because Truthout had an interesting article that looked at CNN's got this new feature, interactive news series, that allows readers to determine the topic to be explored by a journalist. And coming in at number one in a recent survey was, quote, America's widening rich-poor gap.
Yeah, well, I think most Americans really are aware of this because they see it and they feel it every day.
And Arthur, what are your thoughts on how reporters should connect the dots between what's happening at the top and the bottom?
I think the doing what Michael does and just pointing it out is extremely helpful. And it's embarrassing to these companies. And this isn't the way it used to be. I mean, this country was not founded on the idea that we needed to please shareholders. And I think it used to be more embarrassing for executives to make so much more money than the people in their company and everyone else in this country. And there's just been a sort of gradual societal change that has made it acceptable. And there's clearly an effort to move that in the other direction. And another thing that reporters ought to do, and I think they do, is to write about people on the bottom and ask whether this is fair and this is the way it ought to be, where you work 40 hours a week, but you're still poor enough And should it is it right that the government ought to subsidize your basic needs, and that your employer doesn't give you enough to get by?
Yeah, and one other aspect that I'd point out that's really shown by the study you mentioned, that how many CEOs are making more than $100 million, is that what we have to continue to point out, and I think this is the point that was shown by the Ron Johnson figures, is that CEO pay, in fact, the pay of all top executives has very, very little to do with what they actually accomplish for their companies and what their role is. I mean, what was so remarkable about Ron Johnson's pay, I mean, he got that much as his entry contract to move from Apple to JCPenney, but he only lasted at JCPenney for something in the neighborhood of 17 months because he was terrible at that job. And if you map the achievements of CEOs against their pay, you find almost no correlation. You do not find the best paid CEOs producing the greatest profits or the greatest stock gains for their shareholders. You just don't see any relationship. That's because this is a closed club. CEOs who sit on each other's boards, they're the ones who constantly rationalizing high pay. It just doesn't work out the way they say. And that's one of the real flaws in the way we pay people at the very top of our corporate system. And I think that's something that we can't stop showing to our readers, because they need to know that it's not just that these people are getting outsized pay packages, but that they don't make sense in pure economics or in pure corporate policy. So this is money that's really being wasted that really would be deployed much better for the corporation and its shareholders if it went back into the workforce and enabled you got better workers, you got a more stable workforce, because they were being paid a rational amount of money for the work they did.
Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the LA Times. Arthur Delaney is a staff reporter with the Huffington Post. Shoshana in Oakland writes, right now on the New York Times website, there's a piece called Cut in Food Stamps Forces Hard Choices on Poor, and it's placed next to an ad for Tea Magazine Luxury Edition. She writes, it reminds me that in pre-industrial times, the hungry would wait outside the gates of the manor house to be fed the scraps. Maybe we should start to have poor people's marches that end up outside of the homes of people like, say, Paul Ryan. Well, those marches actually do happen, but they don't get that much attention. So thank you for writing in, Shoshana. And on the food stamps, Michael, one of your columns points out that, can you talk about how this works, actually? Because you write about how there's a cost of living adjustment that the program was expected to receive over the subsequent 5 years.
Are you talking about food stamps?
Food stamps, yes.
Well, yeah, I think this was the original plan. The food stamp, the portion of the food stamp benefits that were lost at the beginning of November were originally enacted as part of the stimulus program in 2009. And the idea was that there would be a bump up in food stamp benefits, and that over time, as the normal cost of living increases got implemented in the rest of the food stamp benefits, eventually food stamp benefits would rise to the level that they would have been at, that they were as a result of the increase. And so the increase would be essentially defrayed. It would disappear because regular benefits would come to match that level over a period of 5 years of normal inflation increases. Well, what happened is, as I think Arthur pointed out a little bit earlier in the program, is that as part of some other social welfare bills, including one that improved child health programs, and then there was another one, there was a hard deadline was actually put on that original 2009 increase. First, it was moved to next April, that is April 2014, and then it was moved a second time to November 1st, 2013, and that, of course, is the cut that kicked in. So what happened was Congress gave food stamp recipients this increase. It was supposed to be matched over time by the normal increase in inflation, and then Congress, in two steps, took it away, and that's why we have this big loss, this sudden loss, on November 1st.
And again, specifically, Democrats took it away.
Yes, the Democrats, I have to say, and I've written about this over and over again, Democrats in Congress, and in fact, the White House have not showered themselves in glory in terms of upholding the good progressive social insurance programs that were enacted in the 1930s. I think social insurance, social security advocates, who, many of whom I know very well, are very suspicious of President Obama, who keeps talking about implementing the chain CPI, a lower cost of living adjustment for Social Security recipients, for putting Social Security on the table for a grand fiscal bargain. This is not good policy. It's certainly not progressive policy. And I think you will find when you talk to anybody who's an expert in Social Security that they're very nervous about this.
Hmm. And just quickly, Michael, in about 15 seconds, what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a lot of things. I'm going to be looking more at the food stamp issues. I'm writing a lot about the chain CPI and the damage it will do to people who are on Social Security. All of these issues are all very live to me.
And Arthur, just quickly, what are you working on?
I'm soon writing about how people relying on Social Security retirement or disability benefits who received a COLA cost of living increase for next year have had much of that taken away by the food stamp cut that just happened.
Wow. Well, thank you both for your work. Arthur Delaney is a staff reporter with the Huffington Post, and Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the LA Times. He's been a reporter for 30 years. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How is global warming affecting the oceans? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about ocean acidification. Over the last decade, the rise of carbon dioxide has changed the chemical composition of the oceans, making them less hospitable to many forms of marine life. Each hour, 1 ton of invisible pollution is dumped into the ocean. So how can we fight ocean acidification? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.